The headlines: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says he expects the next U.S. administration to compensate Tehran for the wrong policies pursued by Donald Trump over the past 4 years. Israel launches airstrikes on southern Syria and near the capital Damascus, the second such attack within a week. And clashes erupt between police and people in the French city of Bordeaux in a protest against a new security law that bans filming police officers. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says he expects the next U.S. administration to compensate his country for the wrong policies pursued by Donald Trump over the past 4 years. Rouhani said President Donald Trump's failure to win a second term was the result of his wrong policies. The Iranian president said those policies included issues such as the coronavirus pandemic and racism. Rouhani said Trump's foreign policies also contributed to his defeat in the November 3rd election. The Iranian president says his country's policies are based on reciprocal respect and commitment. He said if the next U.S. administration respects this, the way would be clear to return to conditions prior to January 2017. That's when Trump took office. Tehran has slammed the European signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, namely the UK, France, and Germany, for taking a negative stance over the country's missile program. The trio has long been accused by the Islamic Republic of failing to abide by their commitments under the deal.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has lashed out at Britain, France, and Germany for their stance on Tehran's missile program. Speaking in a meeting with the heads of the country's three branches of the government, Ayatollah Khamenei warned the Iranian officials that the three European countries cannot be trusted. The leader also slammed these countries for complicity with the United States in putting the Iranian nation under the pressure of sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei said the issue of sanctions is a bitter reality and a crime committed by the U.S. and its European partners against the Iranian nation. He also noted that this crime is not new and has been committed against the Iranians for years, but it has intensified over the past 3 years. Ayatollah Khamenei urged people to continue their resistance against such measures. Iran's leader remarks came a day after top French, British, and German diplomats met in Berlin to discuss a joint approach with the incoming administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden on reviving the Iranian nuclear deal. The three European countries also issued a joint condemnation of what they called Iran's latest breaches, including the use of more advanced centrifuges. This as Tehran has itself been critical of the European signatories to the nuclear deal for not abiding by their obligations following the unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the agreement in May 2018. Tehran says the European countries have failed to make up for Washington's reimposition of sanctions. Many believe the European governments lack the political will to counter U.S. measures against the 2015 nuclear agreement.
Regardless of the good cop, bad cop, Jekyll and Hyde game, which is what we've seen between Washington and EU, I think our European colleagues, there's a lack of political will when it comes to Iran. They've been engaging when it comes to the Iranian nuclear accord. In practice, we have been witnessing a lack of political will, like I said, as well as the economic leverage that the Europeans seem to not have over Washington.
The Islamic Republic has also criticized the European parties' inaction on U.S. measures following its withdrawal, while Tehran remained committed to the pact. Tehran argues that its retaliatory measures are in accordance with the terms of the JCPOA. To show its goodwill, Iran has also said it will undo its commitment rollbacks only if the European signatories honor their commitments. Iran says the E3 needs to restore balance to the landmark accord by working to lift sanctions against Tehran. What has left the Iran nuclear deal in jeopardy is indisputably the U.S. pullout in the first place and lack of valor on the part of the Europeans not to get in line with U.S. hostile approaches toward Tehran. However, one should be skeptical to see if the coming U.S. administration can bring anything tangible to save the agreement.
Political activists have sat together in Tehran to discuss the latest crises that have gripped Muslim communities. France's disrespectful comments on the sanctities of Muslims and the recent Arab-Israeli normalization have taken center stage at the conference. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The latest challenges in the Muslim world. This is the main theme of this gathering, attended by political activists. On top of the conference's agenda was the French government's recent blasphemy to Prophet Muhammad, which triggered worldwide condemnation from Muslims and religious leaders.
Insulting the Prophet of Islam is tantamount to blasphemy against all other religions. The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. Religions don't have any issues with each other. As a Jewish scholar, I believe what the French president said against Islam is unacceptable. He has ignored the sentiments of around 2 billion people.
Delegates also condemned Sudan, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates for their normalization of ties with Israel. Last month, Sudan became the fifth Muslim country after Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, and Jordan to establish diplomatic ties with Israel. Delegates at the conference called it a strategic folly and a backstabbing of Palestinians who have been suffering under more than 7 decades of Israel's occupation. Although the Arab-Israeli détente infuriated the Muslim world, activists say it should not come as a surprise and is solely a revelation of their long-standing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power balance.
Experts here find the root cause of regional crises in lack of coordination and a growing chasm between regional states. They say external players such as the U.S. never want this gap to be bridged, since such a division has long been a chance for them to serve their interests in the region. Yusuf Jalalib, Tehran.
Israeli military has carried out fresh airstrikes on Syria's southwest, the second such attack in a week. The Syrian army said a strike targeted an area in the southern outskirts of Damascus, resulting in only material damage. Syrian media reported a separate attack on a village in the southwestern city of Unaitra. The strikes have been carried out from the occupied Golan Heights. Last week, Israeli warplanes targeted military sites belonging to resistance groups in the capital, Damascus, killing several military personnel. Israel frequently targets positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance groups, which have played a key role in helping the Syrian army in its fight against terrorists. Hong Kong's leader has accused foreign governments of intensifying interference in the affairs of the Chinese-ruled city. Carrie Lam said Hong Kong's affairs are China's internal affairs, adding, "The foreign interference endangers national security." She said Hong Kong has experienced the most severe political challenges over the past year. Lam said her government's urgent priority is now to restore constitutional order in the semi-autonomous city. Hong Kong experienced months of mass protests last year over an extradition law. The protests later turned into discontent with a security law China approved earlier this year. Several Western countries suspended their extradition treaties with Hong Kong in the wake of the new law. Human rights abuses in the European Union are on the rise, according to members of the European Parliament. Legislators from across the 27-nation bloc claim COVID-19 is exacerbating the problem. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
A debate on fundamental rights in the EU has just concluded in the European Parliament. COVID-19 lockdowns and reduced access to services due to the pandemic have apparently made the elderly more vulnerable, and other groups too.
Women, children in poverty, and people with disabilities.
The 27-nation bloc's asylum system was castigated during the debate.
We have migrants left to rot and fester in camps, while boats of pregnant women and children are pushed out to sea by state forces in Greece. We have migrants raped with the branches of trees by state forces in Croatia. We have Muslims hounded in France.
It's claimed the EU's attitude towards refugees is facilitating abuses both within the bloc and in neighbouring countries.
Greece, Turkey, Poland, Belarus, Spain, Morocco, Hungary, Serbia, and in some countries, Croatia, they even face torture, humiliation, and sexual abuse.
Governments in EU nations, such as Czech Republic and Hungary, are fueling Islamophobia by the way they are dealing with the refugee crisis, according to experts.
They've sought to interpret that crisis as a one of Muslim invasion. And government narratives, when they're deployed in that way, can be very strong.
Other fundamental rights abuses in the EU are also being highlighted. Spanish authorities are criticised for imprisoning activists in Catalonia.
We spend all our time asking Hungary and Poland to act like genuine democratic states, but we don't do anything on Spain. Without civil and political rights, the European project is done for.
Some lawmakers accuse the EU of hypocrisy in terms of how it tries to export its values.
Let's just take one example, cozying up to Israel and Saudi Arabia, which have appalling human rights records, while at the same time imposing really tough sanctions against countries such as Russia and Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The novel coronavirus keeps rampaging through Europe, with several countries in the continent reporting record new deaths and infections from the disease. Italy reported 853 deaths, its highest daily toll since late March. It also registered over 23,000 new daily infections. The UK recorded 608 fatalities, its highest single-day death since May. Official data show Britain's total cases stand at over 1.5 million. The death toll in France has surpassed 50,000. The country has logged over 2.2 million cases. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron said the country will ease restrictions starting this weekend and lift lockdown measures from mid-December before Christmas holidays. Germany has also announced its plan to ease some restrictions over Christmas and the New Year. The country has recorded over 960,000 cases and nearly 15,000 deaths. The European Union may be on the verge of releasing billions of euros to help Eurozone economies, which have been hit hard by COVID-19. Threatening to delay the release and sabotage the bloc's recovery is a row over the EU's future budget and recovery plan. The package includes a new mechanism that will cut off EU funds to countries which violate the rule of law. Bianca Raimi tells us more.
The EU's economy is likely to shrink in the last 3 months of the year in a double-dip recession if the EU's 2021 to 2027 budget and the COVID-19 recovery plan, worth a combined 1.8 trillion euros, are not agreed upon. On Monday, Poland and Hungary vetoed both. They claim the mechanism linking future transfers of money to the issue of the rule of law is part of an unfair ideological battle being waged by Brussels.
We say a resounding no to all the mechanisms that punish us like naughty children, which treat Poland and other member states of the European Union unequally.
Hungarian Premier Viktor Orban called the conditionality plan a form of blackmail against member states opposed to immigration. Both countries are under EU investigation for undermining the independence of courts, media and non-governmental organizations. And with the condition in place, they risk losing access to tens of billions of euros. And despite fears that imposing new conditions for funding could eventually lead to a breakup of the European Union, the Netherlands and the European Parliament, among others, refuse to accept the budget and rescue package without them. Nonetheless, the German EU presidency is optimistic about finding a solution within days.
We are in the last phase of negotiations. It is not easy, as we all know. But we will find a solution, and I am absolutely certain that we will be able to take decisions in the next couple of days for the EU budget, as well as for the recovery fund, so we are able to release the money. There are countries which are so severely hit by this crisis and which urgently need these means.
Amid all the EU's pressing concerns, getting a Brexit deal done and dusted looms large. The European Union's Brexit negotiator says big differences persist in Brexit trade talks with Britain, but both sides are pushing hard for a deal. Several European leaders are urging the Commission to begin putting contingency measures in place, though, in case a deal is not reached before the transition period ends on December 31st. Bianca Rahimi, London.
U.S. media say President Donald Trump plans to pardon his former national security advisor, who admitted lying to the FBI over his Russian contacts. Trump reportedly plans to include Michael Flynn in a series of pardons he will issue during his last days of presidency. Flynn's secret contacts with the Russian ambassador to Washington was a key part of a probe into Russia's alleged meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Flynn pleaded guilty in 2017 to lying to the FBI about those contacts. He was fired by Trump less than a month into his administration. In May this year, the Justice Department withdrew its case against Flynn. It said his alleged lies to the FBI were not significant. Projected winner of the 2020 U.S. presidential election has formally introduced his nominations for high-profile cabinet positions as the transition of power appears to be gaining momentum.
Today, I'm pleased to announce nominations and staff for critical foreign policy and national security positions in my administration. It's a team that will keep our country and our people safe and secure. And it's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, once again sit at the head of the table, ready to confront our adversaries and not reject our allies.
In an event in Delaware, Joe Biden confirmed that Anthony Blinken and John Kerry will be his secretaries of state and climate, respectively. He also named Alejandro Mayorkas as secretary of Homeland Security. Moreover, Biden introduced Avril Haines to be the director of national intelligence, the first ever woman appointed to that post. The announcements come a day after President Donald Trump authorized his administration to officially begin the transition process. Despite that, Trump has refused to concede and vowed to continue his fight in court. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania and Nevada have certified Biden's win, further dashing Trump's hopes of clinging to power.
3 weeks after the U.S. presidential election, there is still no clear winner. However, incumbent Donald Trump has now permitted the government agency which handles presidential transitions to begin working with Democrat Joe Biden, and key swing states have just certified the election in favor of Biden. Recent polls from top media such as The Economist reveal that nearly half the country wants Trump to litigate, believes fraud swung the vote in Biden's favor, and views Biden's victory as illegitimate. Trump has still not spoken publicly on the subject, only communicating his refusal to concede via Twitter repeatedly. The fact of America's intense division still remains, and many wonder how and if the nation can be united. Even though the election was on November 3rd, many urban areas are still boarded up and resemble war zones. The political chaos continues to feed concerns that the violent protests and rebellions from earlier in the year will return. Biden is starting to unveil his cabinet, which was described by the mainstream media site Politico as a, quote, team of careerists, because not since George Bush the First have so many key positions been handed to personal loyalists and longtime Washington insiders. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party and other party factions have been almost totally excluded.
And then if you look at Joe Biden's transition teams, right, like his Pentagon transition team has someone from Raytheon in it, has someone from General Dynamics in it. If you look at his agency transition team, they have people from Chase in there, from Bank of America, from Amazon, from Uber, from Lyft. These are all companies and people with interest that want to continue the status quo. In Joe Biden's own words, nothing will fundamentally change. And the people, the same executives I just named, the same people, the same think tanks, right? They were still working with Trump.
For Secretary of State, Biden has tapped Antony Blinken, viewed as the architect of Barack Obama's interventionist foreign policy, and the longtime advisor to Biden who persuaded him to vote for the second war on Iraq. Blinken was a major proponent of U.S. involvement in Libya, Syria, Ukraine, the Saudi-led war on Yemen, and is considered a major hawk on Russia. He is expected to push the U.S. to try and rejoin the JCPOA agreement on Iran's nuclear energy program. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Let's wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi.
Iranian Notables, Sources of Global Honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode, you'll get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Saadi and Hafez lived in that era. During the Mongol invasion, some regions in Iran remained intact against the pillage and destruction imposed by the invaders. This was mainly due to the wisdom of the local rulers. For instance, Fars region remained safe because it was under the rule of Sa'd ibn Zangi, Abu Bakr and his sons. There were Solgori rulers who used to consort with the men of letters and were sponsors of artists and poets. Thus, the rule in the region coincided with thriving of knowledge and literature. Therefore, when Genghis Khan and Hulagu attacked the region, the entire region remained safe and secure, and as a safe haven, attracted a group of notables of the era as well. The acclaimed poet Saadi Shirazi has composed poems on the situation of the region in those days. Shams Ghais Razi, too, has explained his wandering in Khorasan and Iraq and asking the help of the great figures of Fars. He explains in details the efforts of Sa'd ibn Zangi's son for development and security of the region and the welfare of the people. The words of Shams Ghais, too, show that the Fars region and the ports and islands of the Persian Gulf were the examples of development, security, and flourishing during the Solgori rule. Another region that remained intact against the Mongol invasion was Asia Minor, which mainly consists of the current Turkey. This region was ruled by Seljuks as powerful kings. The Mongols managed to overcome them only when they had become too weak. In view of this, Asia Minor used to function as a refuge for many scholars and learned from Iran. Many elites had covered one city after another to reach the region to live in security. Among these figures, mention can be made of paragons of the Farsi literature like Jalaluddin Muhammad Molavi or Maulana, Shams Tabrizi, Saifuddin Faraghani, and others. Each of these men was a great personality in mysticism and poetry. With regards to the fact that many of these migrants were Iranian thinkers, poets, and scholars, they took a lot of books with themselves, hence the Iranian culture and Farsi language were transferred to their region. Sham, or Greater Syria and Egypt, were other places that remained immune against the Mongol and even Tartar invasion. Thus, many great scholars migrated to the region and stayed there till the end of their life. The region beyond the Indus River, or Sindh, was another important safe haven for Iran's scholars and literary men. This region was under the rule of Ghur dynasty at that time. It soon turned into an important base of Farsi literature and Iranian sciences. The Ghur rulers were divided into the emirs of Sindh, emirs of Delhi, and emirs of Bengal. They had mainly been trained with Iranian culture. There was a big group of Iranians among the emirs of India who had either migrated to the region a little before the Mongol onslaught or concurrent with the events of Transoxiana and Khorasan. Nuruddin Muhammad Ofi was among the renowned Iranian poets who escaped from the Tartar onslaught to Sindh. Apart from these regions that were mentioned, there were other places where Iranian great men would gather, but we will not touch upon them. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
The debate.
Iran's leader has spoken and has described the illegal sanctions the United States has imposed on Iran with the support of its European partners as a, quote, bitter reality and a crime against the nation. And in terms of the Europeans, he has said that they are constantly adopting positions against Iran, like on Iran's defensive missiles. This is while Britain, France, and Germany possess destructive nuclear missiles themselves. In this debate, we will ask our guest how the Europeans can interfere in Iran by making such a request, and whether the incoming U.S. administration, once confirmed, will adopt the same policy. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, University lecturer and author Daniel Kobalik, joins us from Pittsburgh, and director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Tarabi, joins us from Qom. I'd like to welcome both of you. Sam Tarabi, I'm going to start with you. Iran's leader has said the legal sanctions in the United States that has been imposed on Iran with the support of its European partners, calling it a bitter reality and a crime against the nation. Your reaction to that first, please.
Well, I think, you know, it's pretty obvious that this is the reality and that it is a crime. And if you just look at the amount of people that have suffered over the years, it's not a recent thing. It's been going on for 40 years now because of the sanctions. And now, particularly after we saw during the corona and the COVID epidemic, you know, these are statements, these are facts that I don't think really require us to need to prove them, or that require some sort of a long discussion. These are the realities. These are the facts. I think what's more important is the fact that the leader in this speech and in previous speeches has pointed out to some of the basic strategic issues that are behind the scenes of these policies, of these inhumane policies that the Westerners, whether it's the Americans or the Europeans, are pursuing. And it goes to the heart of the matter, which is that they don't want Iran to be a powerful country, and they don't want Iran to take its place as the natural hegemon in West Asia and to displace America and to displace those countries in the various spheres of countries where they have spheres of influence. For example, France in Lebanon or Syria, you know, Britain in some of the Gulf, Persian Gulf states, or Jordan. So this is about real politics. This is about real power. And, you know, the fact that the Europeans are duplicitous, hypocritic, and don't, you know, act on their word is not something we need to really spend a lot of time discussing. It's a reality and a fact that's been proven over the centuries.
Okay, so our guest there, Daniel Kovalik, talks about the latter half of what he said is what I'd like to elaborate on with you. I mean, we know what the sanctions have done. We know that the U.S. has exerted, as our guest there said, sanctions for decades now. And that has hurt ordinary Iranians. But in the respect and the vantage point of it preventing Iran from becoming a regional power in the region that it's in, do you think that that is one of the aims that the U.S. has had, even though it has backfired, because Iran has subscribed without having the choice, into domestically producing and improving its capabilities in a whole host of fields. But do you think that that was one of the aims, or remains one of the aims of the U.S. and perhaps its partners, to limit Iran's capabilities?
Yes, of course. I mean, we have to start with the premise that the U.S. wants hegemonic control over every region of the world. It believes it has control over the Persian Gulf, that it has a right to such control. Remember the Carter Doctrine? Jimmy Carter said the U.S. had the right to militarily intervene in the Persian Gulf whenever it felt its oil interests there were threatened. I mean, it's literally called the Persian Gulf, right? It could just be called the Iranian Gulf. And yet the U.S. thinks it should have hegemony there. The same thing in the South China Sea. It resents that China has any, you know, say over what happens in the South China Sea. It's absurd. But yes, that is the U.S. goal, is to limit any power in any part of the world that can challenge the U.S. in that region. And Iran really is the only country standing in the Middle East, because the U.S., of course, has destroyed most of the others, that can contest U.S. hegemony. And so we see, for example, that Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, a close ally with the United States, just had this so-called secret meeting. It's not secret anymore, in Saudi Arabia to, you know, form an alliance, an anti-Iranian alliance with Saudi Arabia. It's all part of the plan, and the U.S. is going to support that plan. And I don't care if it's Biden or Trump who's in charge. That will be the U.S. policy. The U.S. has never forgiven Iran for overthrowing the Shah in 1979. And you know, it will continue to harass that country.
All right, let's talk about the incoming U.S. administration, once confirmed, Sam Tarabi. I mean, we just heard from the president-elect Joe Biden speaking just before our program, in which he introduced some of the members of his team. Now, Iran's leader has said, on the nuclear deal, of course, we tried the path of having the sanctions lifted once and negotiated for several years to that effect, but it produced no results. Now, that is due to Trump pulling out of the JCPOA. How do you think Iran is going to deal with this incoming administration? Do you think that it's going to trust the other side, namely the U.S., to go ahead with another deal, if even that scenario is being contemplated by Iran, were it to be approached?
First of all, let's remember that before the Trump administration and before Trump pulling out of the deal, we had the Obama administration not implementing the JCPOA. And the proof of that is, at that time, you had the head of the Iranian Central Bank going to their annual IMF meeting in the U.S., in Washington, and publicly and in English declaring that the results of the JCPOA for Iran have been nothing. He literally said the word nothing. So it's not just the fact that the Trump administration pulled out. The JCPOA itself, even at the time of the Obama administration, was not being implemented by the United States. So let's just get the facts and the history right. And the fact that then Trump pulled out, of course, that then means that there is no agreement in terms of, you know, the main party that Iran was trying to negotiate with. So the reality of the fact is that after Yani, with the coming of the Biden administration, Iran has already officially declared, as stated by Dr. Zarif, the foreign minister, that U.S. needs to compensate Iran monetarily for all the damages that it's done. Obviously, the Biden administration is not going to go for that. So it seems to me that there are very clear barriers towards anything resembling anything that was previous to that. That's number one. Number two, as you may recall, on the day of the election, when the Supreme Leader had a speech, he very clearly stated that it makes no difference who the president is and what the administration in the U.S. is. Our policy, that, in other words, Iran's policies and strategy towards the U.S. are very clear, and it makes no difference whether it's Trump or Biden. As you may recall, at the beginning of this whole process, because you quoted the leader, what he said today, in terms of we tried to lift the sanctions or to relieve the sanctions through negotiations, and it didn't work. Well, let's go back to the beginning of this whole process, when the Supreme Leader at that time said that, go ahead, negotiate, I am pessimistic, this shall be an experience for all of us. So now we've had this experience. We went into the process with goodwill. We stood by all our agreements. None of the other sides fulfilled their part, neither the Americans nor the Europeans. And so now I think it's, bordering on the silly and on the mentally, you know, unstable to be talking about going into another round of negotiations with whoever it is.
Okay, but it's being talked about, and Daniel Kovalik, Iran's leader, has said, in terms of the Europeans, France, Germany, and the UK, he's questioning how they can even talk about having Iran put its missile defense capabilities on the negotiating table when they themselves didn't follow through with their commitments to the JCPOA. And, of course, we're looking again at an incoming U.S. administration once confirmed, that there's been lots of noise about how they may be approaching Iran in terms of the JCPOA. How do you think this is all going to pan out?
Look, I think ultimately the West is going to continue to harass Iran, but Iran is going to continue to do what it needs to do, which frankly it has the right under international law to do, and that is defend itself. I think we learned after the Libya debacle, in which Muammar Gaddafi had agreed to give up any nuclear ambitions, right, to be returned to the fold, so to speak, with the West. He was repaid with an invasion that ended in his brutal murder. The lesson there is you don't give up your defenses. The lesson is the West is not a fair and honest negotiator. You have to do what you do, what you have to do to defend yourself. And North Korea has learned that as well. So Iran will continue to defend itself. It will continue to find allies in countries like China and Russia. And the West will be unhappy, but they'll have to live with it.
Assad Torabi, you talked about how Iran's leader has said that it doesn't make a difference who sits at the White House. Iran is going to go its route, pretty much. Now, I'm going to use Iran's leader's statement here and see what you think of the issue of sanctions in terms of how he addressed it. He said, quote, "If we manage to overcome the sanctions through our own efforts and initiatives while holding firm against the problems, the other side will gradually lift the bans since it will see their ineffectiveness." Is it correct to interpret this as that there's going to be some kind of engagement then, since the other side, once seeing the sanctions is not working, will gradually lift them, as he has said?
Well, why are we so insistent on engagement? I mean, you know, the definition of somebody stupid is somebody who keeps doing something and gets the same results. So we've been engaging for 20 years without strategic deterrence. I'm emphasizing the point that my colleague was making. Iran has to develop a strategic deterrence. The Europeans and the Americans have to know that. Iran will come to negotiations, if it so chooses, in its own interest, with having strategic deterrence. Strategic deterrence means having missiles, having a strategic navy. The one news item, which unfortunately I don't know why we don't report it enough, is that for the first time this week, the Revolutionary Guards officially declared that we have ICBM capabilities. We have intercontinental ballistic missile capability. It's the first time that that Sepah has announced this officially. So this is something that is important. The lesson of the last 20 years of engagements with the West is first have the missiles, then go talk about whatever you want to talk about. This is the mistake that the establishment in Iran has made for the last 20 years. They thought that they are dealing with their cousins, that they're going to sit there and have some sort of an agreement, and that those, civilized, so-called civilized Westerners, which the Supreme Leader has called terrorists in suit, perfumed terrorists in suits, this is what the Supreme Leader calls them, that they are going to somehow stick to their deal, and you know, John Kerry's word is you know has some sort of credibility and all that stuff that we listened to for the last 10 years under this administration in Iran. And the reality is that that's never going to happen because they don't consider Iranians to be equal human beings. They consider it their natural right to be dominating our region. They consider it a right that France, you know, controls Syria and Lebanon. They consider it their right that Britain controls the Persian Gulf states and Jordan. So the idea that, you know, the one nation in this region that is the natural hegemon of the region, I repeat this, I know some people in Iran don't like me to say that, but the reality, if you look at the history of West Asia, is that Iran is the natural hegemon. It's been even declared as such by American strategic thinkers, if you look at the documents during the Nixon administration, as an example. If you look at all the documents that have been declassified over the decades, the Americans, the West, they themselves know that Iran is the natural hegemon, and all of this goes back to the idea that you have to starve Iranians so that they will stop, you know, taking their rightful place in history and in this region. And there is no way of somehow coming to an agreement about this. Either the U.S. is the hegemon or Iran is the hegemon. There is nothing in between. There's no such thing as having some sort of a peaceful coexistence with the U.S., with the Zionist apartheid state of Israel, or with the medieval dictatorships of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. We have one country in this region that has a constitutional republic, and it's called the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's the one country that actually has a constitutional and a republican form where you have elections, where different parties and different views come and compete, and you have different governments coming to power and with different views. You have elected parliament. You have elected local councils. Of course this is a threat to the Saudis. Of course this is a threat to the Emirates. Of course it's a threat to the Israelis, who are occupying, you know, more people on their land than they themselves, the Zionists, are. So these are the realities, and instead of us, you know, repeating some of the ways that the debates are framed in the West, let's talk about this, what it is all about. It's about Iran being a model for the countries of the region, for the Muslim world, of a country who is able to develop itself independently, to form a healthy and a vibrant political domestic scene, to form and to establish its power, as is its right, as is the right of any nation, and to be independent of foreign influence. This is what it's all about. And it's not going to happen with the Americans or the British or the French, you know, allowing us to happen. We have to get it ourselves, and that's what we're doing, and that's what they're fighting us about.
And that's what Daniel Kovalik, the U.S., doesn't want, along with its allies, especially Saudi Arabia and Israel. What do you think they will do to stop Iran, as they have said, in their words, interfering in other regional countries' affairs, and to stop Iran overall from being the power that it is in the region?
Well, obviously the worst-case scenario would be that they would try to militarily assault Iran. And I fear that that is a possibility. I think that that has been on the table for a long time. Seymour Hersh, the journalist, has done some great work on that, you know, saying that there have been plans to attack Iran for some time. I think, you know, every time the U.S. has gotten close to doing it, it's gotten cold feet, because Iran is a very strong country, very populous country that knows how to defend itself. It proved that in the war with Iraq. But I do fear that that's still on the table. And look at what the U.S. has done to countries like Iraq, like Syria, like Libya. They have destabilized them to the point that they are failed states, largely. If they could do that to Iran, they would. Let's face it, they would probably do worse. And so, sadly, that is a possibility. I think any decent person should oppose that. Americans have to oppose that. They have to oppose our government doing that. But I do think that that is a possibility.
And finally and quickly, Sam Tarabi, just recently it was revealed that Trump was contemplating attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. Do you think that that is going to be the all options on the table scenario, going to be what the incoming U.S. administration will also follow through with?
The one single fact over the last decades, especially after the war, after the Iran-Iraq war, is that the U.S. knows that if it attacks Iran, it will be the end of its presence in West Asia. This is the reason why they didn't attack Iran after Iran attacked the Ain al-Assad and the Erbil bases. So this is actually one of those things that is said a lot, especially in the West. But the reality is that actually an attack on Iran is something that would be to the strategic advantage of Iran, because it would then allow us to legitimately and legally attack all American interests in the region, which is ultimately what has to be done eventually to get the Americans out. The Americans are not going to leave on their own accord. The Americans leave places when their soldiers are taken out in coffins and body bags. That's how the Americans leave places. And this is going to be the case in West Asia as well. And unfortunately, what happens in domestic American and in Western media, which then also influences Iranian media, is that there's always talk of, well, you know, if Bernie Sanders comes, this is going to happen. If Biden comes, this is going to happen. It's not going to happen. There's no administration and nobody who is going to become president who has the capability of withdrawing even 500 or 1,000 troops from certain places, because it's not the president who decides these things.
I do apologize for that. That does it for this edition of The Debate. University lecturer and author Daniel Kovalik with the statements, and director of the Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Tarabi. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tawai, entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome again to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. As you are aware, we have been discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184 in Nahjul Balagha. Of course, there are two or three different ways the way they have numbered the sermons, but the famous one is this one that I'm saying, the sermon number 184. Of course, as you're aware, it's known as the Sermon of the Pious People, a very famous and powerful sermon. And if a person spends his time to contemplate on the words that are mentioned in this sermon, you know, if one print it out, the English translation is easily found. If a person were to just go to, for example, Google and search, type down this particular sermon of the pious people, they will find this sermon in the translation. If a person prints it out and, you know, keeps it next to his bedside and sometimes has a look at the different aspects of the sermon, inshallah, it can have a very powerful impact in his heart. We were discussing about the quality called few mistakes. One of the qualities of the pious people is that their mistakes are less. And we tried to discuss, introduce this topic in the previous session. Inshallah, today we will delve a little bit deeper in this matter.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
As mentioned in the first segment of this session, we said that one of the qualities of the pious people mentioned by Imam Ali alayhi salam is qalilan zalalu, that a pious person is one whose mistakes are few. That means he acts in a way that is accurate. He acts nicely, his mistakes are less. In other words, if a person sees that his mistakes are repeating, then he needs guidance. Either it's a psychological problem that needs psychological help, or it is sometimes rooted in some problems of character. And one of the reasons is that when a person doesn't have clear-cut aims and hopes and goals in life, which can lead to these types of problems and issues. As for now, I would like us to analyze this issue in another way, as to why would someone make mistakes? What are the reasons why people make mistakes in life? One reason could be ignorance. But pious people are not ignorant. Why? Because the reason why they are careful about their actions is because they know that God is looking at them. أَلَمْ يَعْلَمْ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ يَرَى. Doesn't he know that God is looking at him? You know? According to Imam Khomeini, he would say that Alam Mahzare Khudast means the whole of the universe is a place where God is present. It's there. God is there everywhere. So if a person has this awareness, then definitely he will keep track of his actions. And his mistakes will reduce a lot. So sometimes it's ignorance. Sometimes, okay, a person might have awareness about God, but he doesn't know what his purpose in life is. He doesn't know the way to achieve it. So the first thing is a person should really increase his knowledge. You notice that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran also told the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, of course in a way trying to teach us, that we should recite this, Rabbi zidni ilma, that increase me in my knowledge. Increase me in knowledge. That means I will increase in my existence when knowledge is added to my existence. That's what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is asking us.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, adding up to what I discussed in the previous segment, we said that lack of knowledge could be one of the reasons why people make mistakes. So a person who wants to become pious would definitely need to therefore increase his knowledge. Another reason would be weakness. The person has the knowledge, but he's weak. He can't perform. He knows that he needs to pray, but he cannot pray because he's weak. In the Quran and in the Sharia, there is nothing like weakness. Why? Because if a person becomes weak or loses energy, or for example, you know, is put in a situation where he cannot perform a certain action, like he's forced not to do that action, then there are other ways out. If he is weak and he cannot do perform the ablution, then there is another thing called tayammum, ablution, a type of ablution where a person uses sand and rocks and dust, for example. So there is no weakness in Islam. La yakun, there is no haraj. There is no haraj in the religion of Islam. There is no rule that is going to break a person in Islam, break him, destroy him. No. Wherever there is difficulty of wherever there is extreme difficulty where a person cannot perform an action, there is a way out in the Sharia. If you say weakness, by weakness you mean a person is weak at heart, that means he follows his desires and his anger easily. Yes, this is a problem. A pious person is not one who follows his desires and his anger. He needs to control his desires. If a person were to think that he remains to be a believer in God, but he is allowing darkness to grow in his own essence, he's allowing the desires to grow, he's feeding them, he's allowing them to take control over him, then of course his mistakes will increase. So his knowledge might be there, of course at a weaker level, but his desires are also present, and this there is always a push and a pull, and this is where jihad with the nafs comes about. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we are able to act in accordance to the statements of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Round the world with reporters.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 15,000 COVID-19 infections and over 65 deaths, mostly since late August. Since Thursday, around 3,000 infections were detected in the impoverished enclave. Hospitals in Gaza currently have less than 100 ICU beds and ventilators for nearly 2 million inhabitants. 80% of ventilators for coronavirus patients have already been taken up. The World Health Organization cautioned that within a week, the health system in Gaza may become unable to care for critical cases.
The situation is becoming extremely dangerous in Gaza amid rapid increase of coronavirus infections, and people here will continue to suffer. The health sector is already fragile and in a very bad shape because of the Israeli blockade. The health system will soon be unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and other health needs.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's health system and almost paralyzed its ability to provide health services by refusing to allow in vital medical equipment amid the apathy of the international community. Unfortunately, some Arab regimes are normalizing ties with Israel and encouraging it to perpetrate more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Local authorities have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is one of the main reasons why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, especially on the health system. The health system is struggling with the logistics, lack of medical equipment, as well as testing kits for the virus and hospital ventilators to keep patients alive.
Rights groups warn that Gaza is facing a catastrophic situation under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing